Well, I mentioned to some of you that just about the atmosphere of this, what I wanted to do for this study. And for those of you who didn't hear, I didn't want it to be something super formal like church where I'm standing up at a pulpit, you know, bellowing at you or something. And I didn't want it to be just some kind of a free-for-all either, you know, like a lot of modern Bible studies are that you go to. So somewhere in the middle where I have something that I'm going to present. But if you have questions, you can feel free to ask, or if you have something you wanted to add or whatever, that'd be fine. Ladies can feel free to speak up too. So what I have today is I've entitled it Divide and Conquer, and it's from Acts 23, 6 through 10. And unfortunately, we're not even going to get to that part today. So that's the really exciting part. So I'll leave you hanging after the study today, and then you'll have to come back next week. So what I want to accomplish with this study is a few things. First of all, we should learn from this study to be wise under the way of this world, under the way the world works, but not to be of it. So we want to know how the world works and know how to get along in the world, but not be part of the world and not act like they do, right? We want to learn how to use strategy when dealing with enemies, and we want to learn how to use our opponent's weakness against them. And I'm sure that's something you learn in martial arts. You learn like in The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Any type of military manual like that will tell you to use your enemy's weakness against them, hit them at their weakest spot. And this isn't some kind of a book study on the Machiavelli as the Prince or anything like that, where we're learning how to be worldly wise men, but the scripture does talk a lot about this, and we're going to especially look at the Apostle Paul and how he used his opponent's weakness against them and how he used strategy to get out of the hands of his enemies. And like I said, next time we'll get into the neatest part of it. But today there should be some interesting things too. And we'll also learn how to use the mechanisms of this world to save us from the wicked intentions of the men in this world. So we'll learn how to use basically their own mechanisms against them in a way to help deliver us from them. So we read in Romans 16:19 that we should be wise unto that which is good, but simple concerning evil. Romans 16:19. Paul says to this church, "For your obedience has come abroad unto all men. I am glad, therefore, on your behalf, but yet I would have you wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil." So if you're going to spend time learning something and being wise unto something, it should be what is good. You know, we don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time learning about what's evil. You know, if we're going to learn about something, you know, Paul says to think on these things, and he lists out all these goodly virtues that we ought to think on, and that's what we ought to be spending our time on. But notice it also doesn't say, I would have you wise unto that which is good and ignorant concerning that which is evil. It doesn't say that. So we're not supposed to be completely out of the loop and not know anything about what's going on in the world and the evil of the world. But the majority of what we should be focused on is what is good. He wants to come up here and get his hands on the Word of God. So Jesus taught us, as you know, to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Over there in Matthew 10:16. We know something about the serpent. It was said of all the beasts of the field, he was more subtle than any beast of the field. Back there in Genesis, we read that. So Jesus said in Matthew 10:16 to his disciples when he was sending them out, he said, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." So the serpent is the most subtle beast of the field. He says you want to be as wise as them, so be paying attention to what's going on. But at the same time, harmless as doves. And the men of this world are as wise as serpents and as harmful as serpents. But we're not supposed to be harmful like serpents. We're supposed to be wise like they are, but harmless as doves. And I don't think a dove's probably ever hurt anybody. He could crap on your head or something as you're walking underneath them. But other than that, doves are pretty harmless. He picked two pretty good animals to show forth his point there. And then Paul teaches us in 1 Corinthians 7:31 to use the world, but not to be of the world, not to abuse the world, but rather to use it. So there are some people that take the position that we ought to not be involved in the world at all, stay out of all that kind of stuff, and leave that up to the worldly people to be in the world. But Paul says that we can use it, but not abuse it. He says there in 1 Corinthians 7:31, "And they that use this world as not abusing it, for the fashion of this world passeth away." You know, there are, when you school your children, you can use the world, but not abuse it. You know, use what the world has to offer there for education, but don't abuse it, and don't allow it to abuse you or abuse your kids. Mm-hmm. But you can use it, you know, and it's there, so we may as well make use of it when we can. And Paul teaches us to walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. So all these verses are telling us, and that's when that one's in Ephesians 5 and verse 15. All these verses are telling us that we ought to be wise men in this world. We ought to know what's going on, know how to live and get along in this world, know how the world works, but not be part of it. Ephesians 5, 15. He says, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is." So that's that wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil. Don't be unwise. Understand what the will of the Lord is. But also, you don't want to be part of the world. You want to walk circumspectly. And circumspectly, before I even define it, it's one of those words, if you know any etymology, this one's a pretty easy one to define just by the two words that it's made up of. Circumspectly. So circum, like circumference, so around. And then spectly, like spectacles, looking. So looking around, mm-hmm. circumspectly. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of thing's fascinating to me, whenever you can take a word, break it down in its parts, and see the see what it means without even having a dictionary. So the dictionary defines it as in a circumspect manner with circumspection. Now I would say they just violated the law of dictionary definitions twice, using the word to define itself. I mean, that's circular reasoning, I would think. It's cautiously, warily, carefully. So that makes sense, right? If you're looking around, mm-hmm. you're being cautious and wary and careful. You're paying attention to what's going on. And we ought to do that. I mean, we ought to walk circumspectly. We should be paying attention to our surroundings, both literally and figuratively, so that we're not taken by surprise. I mean, that just makes sense. If you're walking across the dark parking lot at night, you probably want to kind of look around a little bit, look over your shoulders, and it doesn't hurt if you happen to carry a gun in your front pocket, like some people I know. You might want to have your hand in the pocket, you know, just depending on where you are. It's not a bad idea. You know, the old trust but verify type of thing. You don't need to... We trust God, but yet, like I will get to at the very end, God helps those who help themselves too. Though that's not a proverb and it's not a verse in the Bible. People think it is, but it is a principle that's in the Bible. So, and also figuratively, we want to walk circumspectly too. Just paying attention to what's going on around us. Paying attention in our own church, watching ourselves, making sure that we're not, you know, falling off the wagon here and doing something. If you see a brother going into a sin, you're supposed to take him off the side and help him out. So you want to pay attention. Pay attention to what's going on, figuratively and literally. And we read in Proverbs 22:3, "A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." So the prudent man is the one that can look out ahead, he can see the evil coming, whatever that may be, and he can hide himself. I mean, in the most natural sense, he's the guy that looks ahead and sees winter coming and says, "I better chop some wood. Right. You know, I better get myself some food laid up." Back in the day, I mean, nowadays, you know, we just pay the gas company or whatever, but, you know, back in the day, that would have been a very obvious one. But also, I mean, you can, I think in the times we live in now, without getting into it and getting everybody all depressed, I wouldn't think it's a bad idea kind of look ahead on the horizon, kind of see what you think might be coming, and if you can, hide yourself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. A little bit of food, a little bit of alternate money, a little bit of cash in the house instead of in the ATM, just all that kind of stuff. Just, you never know. It's not a bad idea to foresee the evil and hide yourself to the extent mm-hmm. we can. Jesus commended an unjust steward for his craftiness, and this, if you know where I'm going, I think this is one of the most interesting parables. I think it was a parable, I'm pretty sure. That he told. It's over there in Luke 16. And you, on the face of it, you read the parable, and you just think, well, that just doesn't even sound Christian, hardly. I mean, he's commending a guy for being mm-hmm. dishonest, basically. But I'm not going to say I have a perfect explanation of this, but I can at least derive some points from this that we can definitely use. In Luke 16, 1 through 12, it says, "And he said unto his disciples," this is Jesus, "There was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he wasted his goods. And he called him and said unto him, How is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer be steward." So thou mayest be no longer steward. So here's a guy, he wasted his master's goods. He's like, "All right, you're going to be fired. Give me an account of everything I have here. I want to know what's going on, and then you're out the door." "Then the steward said within himself, What shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him, and said unto the first, How much owest thou unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, Take thy bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then said he to another, And how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, Take thy bill and write 80. So you know what he's doing. He's basically taking the creditors. He says, How much do you owe? 100 measures of oil. All right, just take that and write 50 real quick. And we won't tell the boss. And, I just cut you a deal. This one's on me. Don't worry about it. You know, the next guy, How much do you owe? 100 measures of wheat. Just take it down. Just write 80. You know, 20 bucks is on me, or 20 bushels, whatever it was. That's on me. Don't worry about it. So he just made himself some friends. Mm-hmm. And whenever he loses his job, he's going to have some friends. Mm-hmm. So he made himself friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. And that's what Jesus goes on to say. And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. So I think that's interesting. So here the Lord that this guy ripped off commends him for doing wisely. And I think sometimes, even probably when your kids do something wise but wrong, you almost want to commend them like, "Wow, that was pretty slick. You know, you almost got away with that," or something. "I'm impressed, but you're still getting in trouble," or whatever, you know. And we think like that. I think that kind of thing happens a lot. You know, you commend somebody for their craftiness even though they were dishonest, or you root for the bad guy in the movie or whatever because he's doing such a good job, you know, that type of thing. So anyway, maybe not right, but that's just kind of how we think sometimes. And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. This is Jesus saying that. The children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light. And that's true. I mean, generally speaking, who owns all the big companies? You know, Steve Jobs, was he a Christian? Bill Gates, was he a Christian? All these guys, the wise men of this world that do well and make it, and the rich and the powerful, are they the children of light? Or are they the children of this world? Generally speaking, they're the children of this world. They're the ones that are wiser than we are. But that's all right. We win in the end. We get the last laugh. They can have all this stuff down here. We got a mansion waiting for us, so we don't worry about that. And I say unto you, and here's the interesting part. And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who shall commit to your trust the true riches? And if ye have been faithful in that which is another man's, if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? So he commended the unjust steward for what he did. And then he says, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. Now, I could not say that go out there and rip people off and be dishonest. I can't imagine that's what he's saying, just because that would go against other scripture and what Jesus taught elsewhere. But I would definitely say that we can make to ourselves, like this guy did, only maybe in an honest way, make ourselves friends of people in this world. Get to know people, you know, make yourselves friends with your neighbors. They may be able to help you out someday. Or make to yourselves friends of co-workers that you don't really agree with and like, but yet whenever the promotion comes or whenever it's time to cut somebody, if things get slow, they may like you. And you made yourselves friends of the mammon unrighteousness, and it might end up benefiting you. Mm-hmm. So not to cheat, lie, and steal, but just use the world, not abuse it. That's basically what he's getting at here. So I think I got ahead of myself there a little bit.
Do you think it goes so far as to Pastor Wagner to? I mean, obviously, there's a line with criminal organizations, but some things that are called criminal may not necessarily violate a law of God, and so that criminal is just a stigmata on it, like a black market economy. Make friends with that or have connections with that if that's useful to you. In other words, I mean, because the people who do it in the daylight, they seem kind of corrupt. And like this guy, he did it in the daylight. He's respected certain, but look at the kind of deals they were cutting and contracts he was signing.
No, I think, I mean, I don't, I wouldn't be opposed to using a black market, especially if things get bad to where you have to. I mean, sometimes the black market is the real market. You know, that's what you have to use. So, no, I think that's, that's a legitimate use for this text. So, yeah, use the world, but don't abuse it. I was going to say something, and then it escaped me. So, if we look at just, let's look at just a very brief overview of Acts 23, 1 through 10. And like I said, we're not going to get to it today. I intended to, but then when I got putting the study together, I realized there's a whole bunch of stuff prior to that that kind of is in the same, it all goes together. So, and then I saw how Paul used a couple other methods to escape his enemies prior to that, and I thought, I want to cover all of them. So we won't get to the Acts 23, like I said. But so in Acts 23, 1 through 10, Paul had found himself in front of a Jewish council consisting of the high priest and Pharisees and Sadducees. And in this account, Paul demonstrated to us how to use wit and wisdom to use your persecutors' weakness against them and deliver yourself from them. So that's just coming attractions. That's basically where we're going with this. That's the whole divide and conquer theme. Is he's very wisely used his enemies, used their weakness against them, and their weakness happened to be their disunity. I'll just give you a hint. He used that against them and escaped them, temporarily anyway. Paul, as history tells us, whether you can believe it or not, Paul was martyred in Rome. So he eventually didn't escape completely, but he did escape periodically. He just kept going from one prison to another, and one army rescues him after another. It's pretty interesting stuff as you walk through it, as we will, hopefully. So this is a pattern that we should follow. And just like any other thing that the Apostle Paul did, he said in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 1, he said, to be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. So Paul's he's our pattern and our apostle when it comes to doctrine, even when it comes to how he did things. I mean, he was pretty wise, ran from the authorities different times, got let down over the wall in Damascus in the basket, and he did all kinds of different things. And I don't want to spoil my thunder here, so I'm not going to tell you about a couple of them, but we'll get to that in just a minute. So let's first look at the events that led up to Paul being brought before this council and see how Paul employed a couple different methods to try to save himself from this mob that was trying to kill him. One of the methods didn't really work, though I think it's a good idea. The second method did work, and he kind of got a reprieve for a little while. So let's look at that. His first strategy was using diplomacy to reason with his enemies. And I would say that if this should always be our first option. Whenever it comes to any, even our foreign policy with our country or whatever, or you're dealing with people at work, always try diplomacy first. It's going to help you out the most, it's going to cost you the least, and if it doesn't work, you can always escalate up to something else. But always try diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Our foreign policy is a little opposite of that. I mean, we try to talk to people as we're dropping bombs on them, and then the diplomacy kind of fails, you know, when we're dropping bombs on people and killing thousands of people in a country that 95% of Americans couldn't even point out on a map and don't even know what they supposedly did to us. So, anyway, get off my soapbox on that one. Got to get on that once in a while. Got to turn people's minds around on these things, I think. So, the first one was diplomacy. So the Jews had taken captive of Paul when they found him in the temple. So if you turn over to Acts 21, we're just going to kind of walk through Acts 21 and 22. And see how this all played out. So Paul had been on one of his missionary journeys, one of his evangelistic crusades, and he was going back to Jerusalem, and they told him, I don't know if you remember, but a couple different prophets told him, warned him that don't go back to Jerusalem. You're going to be bound hand and foot, and the guy, I forget, Agabus, I think the prophet, took Paul's girdle and he bound himself. He said, the man that wears this girdle is going to be bound in Jerusalem. And so he had all this witness, but Paul said that he knew that even the Holy Ghost told him that bonds and afflictions abided him. So he knew what was coming, but he was still going to go. He wanted to go back to Jerusalem. He needed to go. And he didn't care what was going to happen to them, or he wasn't worried about it. So in Acts 21, so leading up to this, basically he goes back to Jerusalem. He meets with James, the presiding elder of the Jerusalem church. And James says, hey, you know, there's all these Jews here in the Jerusalem church, and they're all zealous of the law. And we want to know what is the verdict, because we've heard you're teaching the Gentiles. And I'm summarizing this. You can read about it in Acts 21. But he said, we want to know that we've heard that you're teaching the Gentiles, or teaching the Jews among the Gentiles, that they ought to forsake the law of Moses and not circumcise their children, and just basically give up on the law of Moses entirely. And we want to know, what is your position here? What is, you know, let us know. So he says, we got some people here. I think, was there six men, I think. Let's see. He says, four men. In Acts 21:23, it says, do therefore this that we say to thee. We have four men which have a vow on them. So they had this vow, probably the vow of a Nazarite. They were going to go into the temple, purify themselves. They were going to shave their heads, which would be the vow of a Nazarite. Let your hair grow long until the vow is over. Shave the head. And they tell Paul, hey, go in there, purify yourself with them, be at charges with them. You can read that in verse 24. And let everybody know that, hey, all this stuff that they've heard about you telling the Jews to forsake the law of Moses and to not circumcise your kids and everything, just let them know that was nothing. And interestingly enough, Paul did it. He went into the temple, he purified himself with them, and that shows me that the law was being done away with. The Old Testament was being done away with. It was passing away, it was being abolished. But there was a period there from the resurrection of Christ until 70 AD, when the temple and Jerusalem were completely destroyed. There was a period of transition there. You know, Paul said in Hebrews that it was ready to be done. The law was ready to be done away. I think it is passing away. Let me see if I can find that verse. Some verses say it is abolished, and other ones say that it's passing away. So I take from that it was in the process. It was formally and actually abolished, but in practice, it was passing away, and it would be fully done away when Jerusalem was destroyed. And that was in, let me see if I can find the verse. That which waxeth old is ready to vanish away. It's in Hebrews 8 and verse 13. In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. So he's writing, you know, in that transitional period, he said it's ready to vanish away. In another place, he said it is abolished. So officially abolished with the resurrection of Christ, but vanishing away in practice, basically. So up until 70 AD, when the temple was gone, the Jews could still practice part of their religion, part of their former religion. I mean, they could do some of the peace offerings and those type of free will offerings, thank offerings, those kind of things. They couldn't do an offering for sin. Paul said there remaineth no more sacrifice for sin. So they couldn't do any offerings in the temple for sin or anything like that. But while the temple still stood, they could do some of these things. And this verse is really proof of that. Paul went in there, he purified himself with them. And it says, look in verse 26. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishing of the days of purification until an offering should be offered for every one of them. So an offering was offered for them in the temple. So that shows that, and Paul did it. I mean, obviously, if it was wrong, he wasn't going to do it. He wasn't just going to placate the Jews and just, okay, I'll go along with it just because you guys are my family here. No, apparently there was nothing wrong with it up until that point. But it wouldn't be a sacrifice for sin or anything like that. Christ already took care of all that. So anyway, that was thrown in there. No extra charge. Wasn't even in the outline.
No, that's
so
good. That's good. Because it's what Paul didn't do that's kind of important, too. He didn't make a sin sacrifice, which would have violated the new covenant.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really good.
Exactly.
These are hard verses otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah. And I remember I made that statement one time, I think in a sermon I did here a while ago, and Judy asked me about it. She's like, I never knew that, never realized that. And I'm like, I'm almost positive. And I look back, because I just kind of off the cuff, I didn't even go here to this verse. And I was thinking, I know there's somewhere. And then I looked back through and I found there in Acts 21. And sure enough, it said they made an offering. You look back there, and then the vow of the Nazarite, they would make offerings and shave their head and everything. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was kind of a side note. But so he went into the temple with these Jews, and he had an Ephesian with him. Let's just start reading there at verse, let's start reading at verse 26. We already read 26. So starting at 27. Acts 21:27, in case anybody missed it. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men in Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people." See, they're already setting it up. He's against the people. He's a sedition. You know, they accused him in Acts 24, I think. They said in Acts 24:5, "And we have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of sedition among the Jews throughout the world, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." So already trying to get the people against him, saying, "This guy's against the people. He's probably against the government. You know, he preaches sermons that he doesn't like the president or whatever." So they're already trying to set him up. And teaches against the people and the law and this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple and hath polluted this holy place. Now look at the parentheses. For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus an Ephesian whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. So that's as far as I want to go right now. But so they supposed that he'd taken this Ephesian, this Greek, into the temple, which he couldn't do. And they just, you know, made a big deal about it. They didn't actually see him in the temple, but, you know, they supposed it. I mean, it's got to be, it's good enough for me. I don't really need, who needs proof? You know, we're a nation of men and not laws. We don't need to worry about that kind of stuff. So they take him and they get a hold of him and put him in, they basically have him locked down here. And so Paul was, this time, he was providentially saved from being killed by the Jews by the Roman army. So if we look at verses 31 through 36, "And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. Then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains and demanded who he was and what he had done." And is that as far as I wanted to go? Yeah, to verse, what was it? Oh, no, to verse 36. "And some cried one thing and some another among the multitude. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. And when he came under the stairs, so it was that he was borne of the soldiers for the violence of the people." You can imagine what kind of an uproar that must have been. There's so many people there. It's like he's crowd surfing, basically, on the soldiers. I mean, they're holding him up and carrying him up into the castle. "For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, Away with him." So, I mean, this is just total pandemonium. It's just crazy. I mean, you can imagine what Paul must have felt like. And I mean, you just have people coming at you from every angle, and you've got these soldiers that come and snatch you up and are carrying you up into the castle. And I mean, it must have been something, a sight to behold. But so God providentially saves him with the Roman army. It's interesting. Here's people that are enemies of the Jews, enemies of God. They're a bunch of pagans, but God uses them to save his minister, to save his Christian there. So God can use ungodly governments, ungodly military, police, or whatever to save his people. He can use them all. He's not limited just to godly people to help save his own godly people. So the first attempt that Paul used was to reason with the Jews and to give his defense. And I'm not going to read all this, but he asked the guy here in verse 37, "And as Paul was led was to be led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, May I speak unto thee? Who said, Canst thou speak Greek? Art not thou that Egyptian, which before these days madest an uproar and ledest out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers? Paul said, I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city of Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city," that means no average or base city, "and I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people. And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying," so he has to speak unto these people. He's trying to use diplomacy first. So he's going to speak unto the people, see if he can reason with them. And that's basically what he goes on to do here in the next half of chapter 22. And he basically just gives a synopsis of his previous life, how he persecuted the church. Then he talks about his Road to Damascus experience when Christ came and blinded him. And told him he was going to go to the Gentiles, and that's pretty much as far as they listened to him. They said they got very quiet when they heard him speak to them in Hebrew, and they listened very intently, and he goes through the whole thing until he gets to that Gentile part, and then they would have no part of it once he got there. So this should always be our first recourse, like I said, to settle with our enemies quickly before a situation escalates. And isn't that what Jesus taught us in Matthew 5, 25 and 26? He taught us to agree with our adversary quickly. And this is just good common sense advice for every one of us. I mean, this holds true just today, just like it did back then. Agree with your adversary quickly if you can. Matthew 5, 25 through 26. Jesus said, "Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing." So if somebody's trying to take you to court, they're trying to sue you, or that you owe them money or something, hey, especially if you're guilty, agree with them quickly. Try to do some kind of a plea bargain or something like that. And just before he hails you to prison, hails you to the judge, and then he delivers you to the officer, and you end up in prison. Or, you know, I've told people, too, if they're going through a divorce, agree with your adversary quickly if you can. If you can, keep the lawyers out of it and all that kind of stuff. Just try to work it out between the two of you. It'll cost you a lot less money, and you might not get, I mean, you're not going to get thrown in prison, obviously, but just think about that. I mean, you could get taken over the coals a lot worse, or who knows, I mean, half of your estate ends up in lawyer fees or whatever. Some adversaries you can't agree with quickly. They're just wretches, and you just have to stick the lawyers on them, basically, and you have no choice. But if you can, diplomacy, that's the best method. If it's possible, we should try to live peaceably with all men. Romans 12 and verse 18. And that's the disclaimer, if it's possible. See, the Bible is real. I mean, it understands, the writers of Scripture understood the nature of mankind, and so they say if it's possible. You know, Paul says if it's possible. He doesn't say live peaceably with all men, when he knows full well that some people you just can't live peaceably with. So the commandments of God are not unreasonable. Romans 12 and verse 18 says, "If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men." So there's a couple things that I draw out of that. Number one, if it be possible. If you can, do it. Number two, as much as lieth in you. That's basically saying with all your might, with all you have in you, with every resource that you have, try to live peaceably with all men, especially in the church. But even in all men, in the workplace, everywhere you can, if you can, live peaceably with all men. And like I said, they're all men, not just men of faith, but all men. Paul says, "Let us do it to good unto all men, especially they of the household of faith," in another place. I think it's in Galatians 6. But here he says, try to live peaceably with all men, regardless if they're of the faith or not. And it just makes sense. It just, your life goes easier. If you can live at peace with people and not be fighting, your life's going to be easier. I mean, it just makes sense. So having listened up to the point of God telling Paul to go to the Gentiles, the Jews then demanded his death. So like I said, they listen. I mean, you talk about a bunch of bigoted, racist, mean people. I mean, just here's people kind of like Jonah who are mad at God for allowing the gospel to go out to Gentiles, mm-hmm. to these unwashed, swine-eating folks. You know, that they just hate the Gentiles so much that Paul says right there in verse 21, Acts 22, 21, "And he said unto me," this is him relating what Jesus said to him, "Depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. And they gave him audience unto this word, and then lifted up their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for it is not fit that he should live." Not fit that he should live. Just for relaying that God told me to go preach to the Gentiles, it's not fit that he should live. Mm-hmm. I mean, just think about that. Mm-hmm. You think we've had racism problems in this country in the past. Just think about that. And their real problem, I mean, the Jews' real problem with Paul was that he preached to the Gentiles. And as we'll see next time, he had a lot of agreement with the Pharisees about various things like the resurrection and different things. The real problem was the Gentiles. It was the fact that he was going to the Gentiles. They probably could have lived with Paul. They could have lived with this Jesus stuff and the gospel. It was just this, including the Gentile stuff, they couldn't stand. Mm-hmm. But if they had just read their own scriptures, you read through like the book, like Romans chapter 9, for one, Paul, I believe it's Romans chapter 9, Paul quotes a whole bunch of verses in there about the Gentiles being brought into the faith. Just look at this. Here's one from OC, which is Hosea, in Romans 9:25. I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her my beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. So there he's speaking of Gentiles. I thought there was another one. Let me see here. No, maybe it was it Romans. Let me see here. Let me see if I can find this. Yeah. Yeah, listen to this. Romans 15 and verse 9. Let's get verse 8. Now I say that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision for the truth of God to confirm the promises made unto the fathers, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, for this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing unto thy name. That's from Psalms. And again, he saith, rejoice ye Gentiles with his people. That's from Deuteronomy. And again, praise the Lord, all ye Gentiles, and laud him, all ye people. That's from Psalm 117. So, and one more in Isaiah, he goes on to say, and again, Isaiah saith, there shall be a root of Jesse, and he that shall rise to reign over the Gentiles, in him shall the Gentiles trust. From Isaiah. So, he just had there about four verses that he quotes about the Gentiles all through Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Psalms. I mean, you basically have the Law, the Prophets, and the Psalms right there, all saying that the gospel is going to go to the Gentiles. And yet, for whatever reason, I guess for the same reason they crucified Jesus, because they didn't know the prophets that were read every Sabbath day,
right,
they crucified him and condemned him.
Pastor Wagner, back in John 15, when these same Jews want to get rid of Jesus, they use the same words and said, away with him, away with him.
Yeah.
And the same thing that we ran into Acts with what they said, the mob
exactly
said about
right.
Paul and the other
yep.
verse.
That's exactly it's really right.
A parallel there.
Yep. And they did the same thing in when Jesus was before Pilate, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Same
yeah,
thing.
That's
away.
This one.
Oh, John. Yeah. Oh, okay. John 15.
I'm sorry, John 19. I'm
19. Okay. Okay.
Absolutely. Verse 15.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Sorry. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. Away with him. We can't have this. Can have these people. So the chief captain, he then commands him to be bound and to be scourged so that he can find out why the Jews cried against him. So look at Acts 22:24. I'll read and then comment. This is pretty funny. The chief captain commanded, so the Jews are all upset, away with him, he shouldn't live. The chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know wherefore they cried so against him. I mean, is this jurisprudence or what? I mean, here, they're crying against this guy. Bring him in here, beat the living daylights at him, because I want to figure out why they're crying against him. I mean, what is that? I mean, what kind of law system is this that you scourge somebody to find out why somebody's saying something bad about them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, it really,
yeah.
really made me laugh when I read that. I mean, it probably wasn't funny for Paul, but it's kind of funny for us looking back on it, you know. So this is not the first time that a righteous man was guilty until proven innocent. See, in our justice system, supposedly people are innocent until proven guilty. I'm pretty sure that's the way it was supposed to be in the Roman Empire too, but they did the same thing to Jesus. Guilty until proven innocent. If you look over there in John 18:29. Just interesting, just like you just mentioned, Paul was walking in the steps of Jesus, as they did to him. You know, Jesus said, the servant's not above his,
mm-hmm.
not greater than his Lord. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, they'll do it to you too. So you can expect it. If it happened to him, it'll happen to us too. In John 18 and verse 29, Pilate then went unto them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up to unto thee. I mean, hello, he's guilty. I mean, you think we bring innocent guys up here or what? Yeah, they want to know, well, of course he's guilty. If he wasn't a malefactor, he wouldn't be here. I mean, come on, what are we talking about? I mean, just this is the reasoning of people. It's just funny. And we do the same thing, though. I mean, we hear somebody in the news, they get brought up on charges for something, and what do we automatically assume?
Guilty.
He's got to be guilty. I mean, they don't bring innocent people up and bring charges against them. He's got to be guilty. Mm-hmm. Has to be. So, I mean, in a way, it's just human nature. And it's also crafty ways for men to try to set up the innocent, too. Mm-hmm. This kind of reminds me of Jay Carney, President Obama's press secretary, when he's defending the president's kill list. When they killed that Anwar al-Awlaki, I think was the guy's name, over in Yemen, he's an American citizen. He's a Muslim cleric over there, supposedly a terrorist. Maybe he was. He probably was a bad guy. I don't know. But we sent a drone over there and killed that guy. Mm-hmm. No trial, no jury, right. No nothing. Right. And his 16-year-old son.
Right.
Killed him. I mean, I don't know if it was at a barbecue or something, but anyway, he dropped a bomb on him. And they asked Jay Carney about this. I mean, this. I feel bad for this poor guy. I don't know if he like buys into all Obama's stuff or not, but he has to defend him. He has to get up there and pretend like he agrees with all this stuff and make a complete fool of himself, basically. But they asked him, like, are you going to provide evidence for us that this guy was who you said he was and that he actually was a bad guy and all this stuff? And he just said, no, not really. No, we're just, he was a bad, I mean, this is my paraphrase, he was a bad guy, you know, and that's really all you need to know.
Right.
I mean, just no justification.
We wouldn't have killed him if he wasn't bad.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if he wasn't a malefactor, we wouldn't have killed him. I mean, obviously. It's terrible. I mean, that's the condition that we're in. I mean, you know, that Obama has, not to get into politics again, but he has the kill list. This was even written about, and Andrew Napolitano, I mean, mainstream guy, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, I think it was, Wall Street Journal, I think it was New York Times, about Obama's kill list. I mean, it's mainstream. And that they review it with him every week, and okay, who do you want to kill today, or who do you want to kill this week, Mr. President? And they send a drone over there and kill him.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, mainstream. I'm not making this stuff up.
What does the drone do? Is it a bullet or?
No, the drone plane. They drop Hellfire missiles from the drone planes. Yeah,
they don't feel anything.
Yeah, no, they don't feel anything, and neither do a whole bunch of innocent bystanders around them.
Yeah.
They have killed, and don't quote me on the number. I think it was like 231 children. Over in Yemen and Pakistan with these drones by accident. I'm sure they're not over there killing children on purpose,
collateral
but still,
damage.
Collateral damage, so to speak. Mm. And yeah, it's awful. I mean, it's terrible. Nobody knows about it. Mm-hmm. You don't hear about it in the mainstream. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And then some psycho kills a bunch of kids in Connecticut, and it's a tragedy. Mm-hmm. And it is. Mm-hmm. But we've killed way more than that overseas, mm-hmm. and it's not a tragedy. They're the wrong color to be a tragedy over there. They're bad people or whatever they are, you know? It's terrible. It's awful. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox again. So apparently it was customary to scourge an innocent man also under Roman rule, which I don't think it was, but they kind of did that too. You look in John 18:38, says there, Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews and saith unto them, I find no fault at all. I find in him no fault at all. So Pilate examines the guy, Jesus, finds no fault in him whatsoever, okay? So then he said, you got a custom, we'll release unto you one prisoner a year at the Passover time. You want me to release Jesus? No, we want Barabbas, we want a robber and a murderer. So verse 19 and verse 1, then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. I find no fault at all in him, now I'm going to take him and scourge him. I mean, what is going on? I don't know. So this was Paul's first... His first try, his first strategy was to use diplomacy with him, and that didn't work. So the army ends up rescuing him. They're going to beat the crap out of him because they want to figure out why he's being accused. And so he uses his second strategy now. His second strategy is appealing to the law to escape from your enemies. This is his second one, and this one worked for him. He got away for a while anyway. So at this point, Paul uses his wild card, and he asks them if it's lawful to scourge a Roman who's uncondemned in Acts 22 and verse 25. So the army rescues him, takes him up into the castle, and all these people are crying. You say he's just a terrible guy, away with him. He didn't fit to live. So they're going to scourge him to figure out what's going on, and they start to bind him. And in Acts 22, I'm in 23, Acts 22 and verse 25, and as they bound him with thongs, I guess they didn't have any ropes or something. I don't know. It's a strange thing to bind somebody with. It gives you a weird visual. But anyway, and as they bound, it's a different type of thong. Anyway, it was terrible.
I was thinking that same visual, though. That sounds so bad.
All right, anyway, that was bad. Sorry. So
you've lowered the whole atmosphere
of the Bibles. Okay, anyway. The thong's like a little straw, a little cord or something like that. I looked it up in OED today. Just to, They don't have a modern definition in there for some reason, but anyway.
It's kind of the same definition.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, all right, let me be editing this MP3. So, and as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? Now that's what you call a rhetorical question. Of course it's not lawful to do that. He's basically, instead of telling him, hey, you can't bind me, he's like, hey, are you allowed to bind somebody and scourge them who's a Roman citizen and hasn't been condemned? Well, that makes the guy step back a little bit. Wait a minute here, what's going on? I didn't know this. So what Paul is doing here is he's appealing to the law of the land, which protected him as a Roman citizen. He had certain rights as a citizen that he was appealing to. And you can look at Acts 21:39, which I think we already read. We did. When he said that he's a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city of Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. And this is a city in the Roman Empire. And he reiterates that back in Acts 22 and verse 3. And it wasn't just any city in the Roman Empire. It was Cilicia, which he said was no mean city. It was apparently an upstanding, you know, a good city, like Minneapolis probably, something like that. So he appeals to his Roman citizenry as his trump card. Well, this wasn't the first time that Paul had appealed to his status as a Roman citizen. You look in Acts 16, just back a couple chapters. This time, Paul had gotten himself into trouble again. He went into Philippi, and they met this woman there that was crying. She had an evil spirit, and she was crying that these men are the servants of the Most High God, there in verse 17, and was showing to us the way of salvation. So here's some woman with a devil, mm-hmm. which is saying absolute truth. Mm-hmm. I couldn't preach more pure truth from the pulpit than she just said there. These are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation. Mm-hmm. She's absolutely right. And you know what Paul does? He doesn't say, well, thanks. You know, nice compliment. I appreciate that. And this she did many days, but Paul, being grieved, turned and said to the Spirit, I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he came out the same hour. So you know what that tells me? There are people out there that have evil spirits that are preaching truth. Not all, everything they say is truth, but they are preaching elements of truth. Satan himself is transformed into the angel of light. His ministers are transformed into ministers of righteousness. So just because you go to these other churches and you hear a guy and he says a lot of good stuff. I mean, they're probably teach you how to be a good father and a good husband and how to manage your money well and all this kind of stuff. But just because they're giving you some truth doesn't mean that is a spirit of God that is right. Preaching that truth. Right. It could be, it's a good deception. You know, if Satan's going to sell lies, you got to sell it with a lot of truth. You give a lot of truth, a little bit of lie, you slip it in there. It's like what's that poison in rat poison?
Cyanide.
Cyanide, I think is what I'm thinking of, yeah. No, fluoride's what they put in our drinking water.
Come on. I don't know how you
yeah.
use those.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably for the same reason. Anyway, I'm not kidding. That's way out there. That's conspiracy theory stuff. Before you know, you're talking about chemtrails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My name's Steve Bylon.
Yeah. All right.
As your picture on it, the drone can look for.
All right. So where was I? So. Paul, appealing, I'm getting way off track. It's going to be way longer than I wanted it to. But anyways, Paul was appealing to the fact that he was a Roman citizen. And this isn't the first time he did it. So yeah, back to Acts 16. I totally got sidetracked there. He cast the devil out of this woman. And these people, she brought a lot of money to these men, as I remember right. Let's see here. Yeah, in verse 19, and when her master saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul and Silas, drew them into the marketplace under the rulers. And once again, here's these people, they're troubling the people. And so here's what really ended up happening was it hit them in the wallet, and that's what they were upset about. You know, they're not upset about anything else. But, you know, they said, where was it that they said? Yeah, in verse 21, and they teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe being Romans. They don't care about the customs they're teaching. They just cut off their money supply. That's what they're mad about, just like the silversmiths with Diana in Acts 19. Same thing, by this craft we have our wealth. Oh, but the Diana that the whole world worshipeth, she's in danger of being dishonored or whatever. No, it had nothing to do with that. It was hitting him in the wallet. I mean, that was the whole point. So anyway, They commanded them to strip them off of their clothes and beat them. There in verse 22, they beat them, they lay many stripes on them, then they bind them fast in the prison. So Paul then, after that, in the prison, you know, there's an earthquake and the prison doors break open, and the Philippian jailer gets converted, all that stuff happens. Then the next morning, I think they realize that these guys really didn't do anything worthy of stripes. So they tell the jailer, hey, let them go. They're in verse 35. And when it was day, the magistrate sent the sergeant, saying, let these men go. And the keeper of the prison told the saying to Paul, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace. But Paul said unto them, they have beaten us openly uncondemned, being Romans, and have cast us into prison. And now do they thrust us out privily? Nay, verily, but let them come themselves and fetch us out. And the sergeants told these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. So here Paul uses his Roman card again. The only thing was he used it a little late. This is after he got beat and put into stocks. You know, he should have used it earlier, but he used it a little bit late. But look at the response. I mean, they feared when they heard that he was a Roman. I mean, these people actually respected people's civil rights. They respected your rights as a citizen, which is something that is largely lacking in our culture, in our country right now. So you see the difference in these people once they find out. See, first they say, hey, you know, they send a sergeant unto him and say, let these guys go. Get them out of here. We don't want them polluting, you know, these Christians polluting our prisons. And then when they find out they're Romans, they change their tune a little bit. Verse 39, and they came and besought them. So they besought them. Now they're asking them. They're not telling them. And they besought them and brought them out and desired them to depart out of the city. So change their tune just a little bit. They did. And so Paul realizes, hey, apparently back in Acts 16, this Roman card works. I'm going to try this thing later. Well, that's exactly what he did over here in Acts 22. Is it lawful to beat them? How did he say it? In Acts 22 and verse 25, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman being uncondemned and uncondemned? So he's using the Roman card again. And he apparently had learned his lesson from the other time, because now he uses it before he gets beat. The other time he uses it after. So this time he uses it before, and it worked out, right? All right, so let's see where it was. I was kind of getting off the outline here. I want to make sure I didn't miss anything. So this is a lesson for us, too, that at times it may be wise to appeal to our rights as U.S. citizens if we're being persecuted wrongly. I wouldn't say every time, but at times it makes sense. We still have some semblance of law and order in this country, and U.S. citizenship is kind of respected sometimes. The Constitution is at least paid lip service to, so sometimes maybe you can appeal to that. Hey, I have a freedom of speech. Why are you handcuffing me for letting my opinion be known or whatever? You know, you could apply to that Constitution, say, I am a U.S. citizen. I have the right to do this, and this Constitution gives me, or I wouldn't know, let me rephrase, it doesn't give me, but it protects that right, or it should. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say in every case, though. For instance, there are certain times when to do that, to appeal to the law, gives them jurisdiction over you. You're admitting that you are under their jurisdiction. For instance, like, you guys don't homeschool, but if homeschoolers, if they the law comes after them, a lot of times they want to always appeal to the Constitution or to our rights as Americans. We have the right to homeschool our children. But when you do that, you admit that we are, that our children are basically under the law. We're governed by the law, and the law has the right to allow us to homeschool or not allow us to homeschool. If you just appeal to the Scripture and say, these are my children, God gave them to me, and God has given me the responsibility to educate them, and I can do it however I see fit, whether it's homeschooling, whether it's private school or public school, but they're my kids and I can do it, then you don't give them footing. And then, and I think Pastor Mott said this lots of times, then they're forced to argue from the Bible instead of argue from the law. And they don't want to argue from the Bible. They don't know anything about the Bible. And you have the upper hand then. The Ecclesiastical Law Center is big on that too. Just like churches that get themselves entangled with properties and things like that, you don't want to appeal to the law. Appeal to the Scripture and show that our church is a church of Jesus Christ. He's the only head, and we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, and this is none of your jurisdiction and none of your business. It's just easier not to have land if you're a church. And that saves a lot of these problems anyway. But anyway, I wouldn't always say that appealing to being a citizen is the way to go, but sometimes it is. Now, when the centurion found out that Paul was a Roman citizen, he stopped binding him and told the chief captain, verses 26 through 29. When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, "Take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman." Then the chief captain came and said unto him, "Tell me, art thou a Roman?" He said, "Yea." And the chief captain answered, "With a great sum obtained I this freedom." And Paul said, "But I was freeborn." So this guy had went through a naturalization process apparently and paid a lot of money to become a Roman citizen. Paul says, "I was born this way. I mean, I have this as a natural right for me." Verse 29, "Then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him, and the chief captain also was afraid, after he knew that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him." So once again, they are fearing the law. The magistrates, the lawmen are fearing the law, and that is something largely lacking in our country. You don't see that kind of thing anymore. The police do not fear the law. Congress certainly doesn't fear the law. They pass laws against the law every day. They certainly don't fear it. They don't care about it. But I would say it's a good government. Let me make sure. Yeah, so they stopped binding him. He was afraid when he found out that he was a citizen. And it's a good government that fears the law and respects its citizens. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Roman Empire eventually fell apart and turned into a bread and circus society. But for a long time, well, despite throwing the Christians to the lions and that kind of stuff, you know, little stuff like that, they were a pretty decent government sometimes, you know. So anyway, I mean, obviously they had their issues, but they did respect law and order, which is interesting. And as you go through Acts, I think it's interesting. I may do a study someday on good civil government. And different times in the book of Acts, they took him to a magistrate about these questions about religion, and the guy's like, "I'm not going to hear this. It's just questions about your law. See to it. I don't want to hear any part of this." And I totally agree. Keep that stuff out of the courts. Deal with it in the church. I mean, the courts have no business in religion.
Right.
They shouldn't have any part in it. One of the law's fundamental functions is to protect citizens from their government, which is the purpose of the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution. That's what it's there for. It's not for them to have power over us. It's for us to have power over them. The Bill of Rights is to protect us from the government and to restrain the government. It's not to restrain the people. The Second Amendment is not about, you know, limiting what type of guns we can have, like some people try to use it as, or whatever, right, or saying it's only for a militia and it's not for the common person or whatever. No, that is to protect our rights, is to protect us from the government. Mm-hmm. That's what it's there for. And our founders knew that. Listen to this quote from Thomas Jefferson. I'm sure you've heard it before. He says, "Let no more be said about confidence of men," that is of men in politics, men in power, "but bind them down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution." That's what he thought about his comrades there in government. Bind them down with the chains of the Constitution. That's what it's there for. Now, this wasn't the first time that Roman magistrates feared when they trampled on the rights of a citizen, and we already looked at back there in Acts 16. Once again, when they found out he was a Roman citizen, they feared, and they kind of walked softly up there instead of just demanded he get out. You know, so they had some respect for the law, which is a good thing. Now, Paul asserted his rights that time, and he was so confident that, I don't know if you noticed that, but he demanded that the magistrates come and personally release him from prison. And they did it. You know, they came in Acts 16. He said, "Let them come and let us out. They beat us, being Romans and condemned." And he was so confident in his right as a citizen that he demanded.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's the best way to do. Don't ask, just tell. It's kind of like, you might not want to use this all the time, but like at work, whenever I wanted a day off, and this kind of works, I wouldn't ask if I can have it off. I would just kind of say, "Hey, I'm taking this day off, and let me know if that's okay," or something. And then you've assumed that I'm going to take it off. And then if they really don't want you to, then they can back off. But if you ask, they can much more easily say no.
Right.
So anyway, don't try that in church, by the way. It won't work. So anyway, I'm giving you bad tactics. Yeah, I shouldn't be telling you this stuff. So yeah, they changed their tune whenever they found out about Paul's status. Now, being humbled and having found out about Paul's civil status, the chief captain, he then adopts a new method of investigation rather than the beat first, ask questions later method. Before, it's like, "Hey, these are crying against him. Let's beat the tar out of them and see what's going on here." Now he thinks, "Well, maybe we'll actually question him first and then beat him afterwards if he's found guilty." You know, there's a novel idea.
Mm-hmm.
So Acts 22 and verse 30, it says, on the morrow, because he would have known the certainty wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Now just contrast that with what he did in verse 24. So here in verse 30, because he would have known the certainty wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands. Verse 24, the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade him that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know whereof they cried so against him, and as they bound him. So he does the complete opposite. He wants to find out why they're crying against him. Now he's going to unbind him, let him go, not beat him. So he removed the handcuffs and gave Paul his day in court to face his accusers. This is the way that Roman law was supposed to be administered. If you look over a couple chapters later in Acts 25, this is how it's supposed to work. In Acts 25 and verse 16, this is Festus when Paul was in prison with him in Caesarea. Paul has appealed to Caesar. Festus is going to write a letter to Caesar and let him know what's going on with Paul. And he says, and he writes there in verse 16, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. So that was the Roman manner. I mean, you especially don't kill somebody, but you don't even beat somebody until the accused has his accuser face to face. This is what we call, and what we were under for a long time in this country until just recently when it was repealed, mm-hmm. It's called the writ of habeas corpus.
Right.
Having your accuser face-to-face. That's something that we had in this country forever. You would not be accused of something if you couldn't have your accuser face-to-face. Mm-hmm. None of this stuff where you're just accused and they go off and try you without even having a chance to defend yourself and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Habeas corpus, and I forget, it's Latin, means something, face-to-face.
Present the body,
that's right, yep.
Corpus
body. So, yep. So that was called the writ of habeas corpus, but really with the Patriot Act and with the National Defense Authorization Act and all this stuff that they've signed within the last decade or so, really habeas corpus is about done.
Right.
Because with the Patriot Act, they can send you down to Guantanamo Bay for virtually anything if you're a, quote, terrorist. National Defense Authorization Act, they can use the military to arrest you. They can arrest you without charge, without warrant, American citizen on U.S. soil, just because they want to, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're for any reason. I mean, they say Obama had a signing statement, oh, I'd never use this against American citizens. Mm-hmm. Why'd you sign the thing then? And then the interesting thing was, some journalists took that to court, and a judge threw it down, and say that this is completely unconstitutional, and Obama's lawyers go back and argued tooth and nail to get that reinstated and have him have the power of indefinite detention without due process. And he has a signing statement, I won't use this on U.S. citizens. Why in the world would your lawyers go back and work as hard as they can to get it reinstated? And it was appealed and over, so it's back, it is the law of the land again, is my understanding anyway. So anyway, that's terrible. I mean, that's just another one of these things that's awful. I mean, we're heading down to a road of tyranny fast. It's not
mm-hmm,
good.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul's appeal to the civil law had spared him a beating. It worked. They stopped binding him, they loosed him, and they're going to counsel the other, and they're going to find out what the guy did wrong. So it saved him a beating. Paul could thank God for delivering him out of all his persecutions. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 11. This will be our closing text, and I'll be done. I think we looked at this verse on Sunday, I do believe. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 11, Paul says, persecutions, afflictions, which came unto me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. He says, out of them all the Lord delivered me. So the Lord once again delivered Paul. He was in the hands of wicked men. He was going to get a beating and be bound. And Paul used some wit and helped himself, and the Lord helped him. That's like the old saying goes, the Lord helps those that help themselves. He did. He used wit and wisdom, and the Lord blessed it and saved him out of a beating anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, we'll look at next time what he did. He goes before the council, and he was even wittier this time. And it's great. I wish we had another hour, but we don't. So you're going to have to wait till next time, but believe me, you don't want to miss it. I think if you like this one, the other one's going to be twice as good.
Good
I
cliffhanger. Think. Very good. Thank you, Pastor Wagner.
Sure.
I'm a little less.